So first, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to speak here, and for the chocolate. But I'd also like to, and I hope you'll join me, in thanking them for having a conference with what has been, up to now, such interesting talks. So that said, I'd like to talk about what has become one of my favorite polynomials, so f. And so what f is, it's the product from I equals 1 up to n minus 1 of the determinant of this I by I submatrix inside all matrices. So this is a polynomial in Z bracket x11 up to xnn. So I've got n by n matrices, and so the first term here is x11, and x1 is about 2 by 2. I take the product of those, and I get this thing of degree 1 plus 2 plus 3 up to n. N plus 1 choose 2. And what can I do with this? I'm thinking now of this as a hypersurface inside. So I'm going to start with this hypersurface inside n by n matrices. And what I'm going to do with it is I'm going to decompose into, and well, it's easy in the it's easy to see what this decomposes into n minus 1 pieces, where just one of the determinants is equal to 0. And then I want to intersect those pieces. And the intersection of those is often not going to be irreducible. So for example, if I say z11 is 0, and I also say that, x11, and I also say that x11, that this upper 2 by 2 is 0, well, that kills off this, so you find out this is x12, x21. So one of these, for when you decompose this, one of those two is going to be 0. So after I intersect, I'm going to want to decompose again. And I'll repeat until done. And you can ask, what do you get? So, I mean, I will get done, because after a while I'll be getting smaller and smaller dimensional subvarieties. And you can ask what subvarieties of matrices this will produce. And in this case, this produces matrix Schubert varieties. So, let me tell you what those are. For each pi in Sn, I want to define x pi bar as, I'll take pi, the permutation matrix, and I'll hit it on the left with lower triangular matrices, so B minus, and I'll hit it on the right with upper triangular matrices, B plus, and then I'll take the closure inside matrices. So why is this called a matrix Schubert variety? Well, if you take the closure inside GLN, or you take this thing and intersect it with GLN, and then you divide on the right by this, you get exactly your usual Schubert variety in GLN mod B. So this is some version of Schubert varieties for people who can't handle projective varieties and insist on things being affine. And sometimes I'm one of those people. So, but I think of it as somehow it's all hiding, all of this structure, you know, the whole permutation group with the Bruha order, it's all hiding in that hypersurface because this algorithm digs it out of there. Okay? And let me put on one more ingredient, which is I can take unions of these. And when I take unions of these, then I'm going to get not just, of course, matrix Schubert varieties, but unions of matrix Schubert varieties. Okay? And so the fact, in this case, if you do this algorithm, I'm saying, union, decompose, intersect, and so on, all these intersections are reduced. So ordinarily, you might think, well, I might get the same set a number of times, but when I take unions and such, I might get a different scheme supported on there. I mean, one way to believe that you just get matrix Schubert varieties is to notice that the original F, or the original hypersurface, is invariant under this B minus cross B plus action, and there's only finitely many orbits on matrices that B minus cross B plus action. They're indexed by partial permutation matrices, where you might have a whole row of zeros. So that's an easy way to say that you're only going to get finitely many sets this way, subsets, but you might worry that you might get infinitely many different schemes on them. But no, you only get reduced schemes this whole way. So let me show you an example where I could have started with a different F. So not so for F is x times y times x minus y. So there, I would start with this hypersurface in the plane, this union of three lines, and I decompose, and I get the three lines, and I intersect any two of them, and I get a point. Sounds good. But if I take the intersection of one of these lines with the union of the other two, that's a double point, right? I mean, easy to see if you move the line a little bit, and the intersection is 2 points, and put it back, and the 2 points fall together, and get a double point. So that says that Schubert matrix Schubert varieties somehow don't intersect like this. This is a badness you don't have to worry about with how matrix Schubert varieties meet one another. Okay. So I'm going to show you another example. What if, and here I started with a polynomial in an affine space, but now I'm going to do one in a hypersurface in the Grassmannian. So now let's let X be the hypersurface in the Grassmannian defined by the first Plicker coordinate is equal to 0. And so that so far is, so this is inside the Grassmannian of D planes, in CN. And so far that's a nice irreducible divisor. It's the Schubert divisor. But then I want to take the union D equals 1 to N and of chi to the D times that, where chi is the shift matrix that rotates things by 1. Okay, so I'm taking the N cyclic shifts of the Schubert divisor on the Grassmannian. And so what that means is maybe not, so this is a Plicker coordinate, you might say this is P, 1, 2, 3, up to D. And now I'm asking that P, 1, 2, 3, up to D times P, 2, 3, 4, up to D plus 1 times all that being 0. Okay? So again, the first step, decomposing this thing into its components, well, there's going to be N of them. For each value of D. And then I'm going to intersect them, and then I'm going to decompose again and intersect and decompose. And so what you can ask first is, what things do you get? What's the analog of this? What's the analog of a matrix Schubert variety starting from this? And what's going to be true again is that all the intersections will be reduced. But let's I'll leave that until the Frobenius splitting stuff. So, I have too many D's. Let's make this I. Sorry about that. Okay, so what subvarieties of the Grassmannian of D planes in CN arise? Okay, so here's a I'll get to the, I'll answer that, though not, it'll take a couple of minutes talking about what seems not wholly related. So let V, V minus 1, V naught, V1, V2 be an infinite sequence, but n periodic sequence of vectors. Okay, so that Vn plus I is equal to Vi for all I. Okay? And let me construct something associated to this infinite sequence. So for each I, find the smallest j more than I, such that Vi plus 1 up to Vj is linearly dependent. So what's the largest that j could possibly be? I plus n. What's the smallest that j could possibly be? I, because Vi could be the zero vector. Okay, so that all by itself, it's linearly dependent. But so this j is somewhere between I and I plus n. Okay? And then defined f from z to z that takes I to this j, you know, the j associated. Okay, so what properties does this f have? The obvious one is this, that f of I is somewhere between I and I plus n. Another obvious one is that f of I is between I and I plus n. Another property is that it's periodic. F of I plus n is equal to f of I plus n. Okay, but there's a third one, which is that it's one-to-one. So why is that? If you so why is f one-to-one? So I've got some vi, and it wants to map by f to some vj. And now I have some other guy, Vi prime, that also wants to map to Vij, right, under F. So what would that mean? It would mean that there's some linear condition, there's some linear dependence relation on these that uses both of these, right? That says this is dependent on what comes next. There's some linear relation that uses both of these and some linear and stuff in between, and some linear relation that uses both of these and stuff in between. But then you could take a linear combination to cancel the dependence on here and find out that Vi was already dependent on what came before. So J was not smallest. So by the periodicity, F is also onto. So if F were a map, if a one-to-one map from a finite set to itself, then you'd believe me. And this makes it close enough to being such a map. Okay? So let me introduce three sets. One is F is goes from Z to Z, and F of I equals F of I plus N is equal to F of I plus N. And this is the affine Weyl group of GLN hat. So this is a SN semi-direct product ZN. And it's not quite what people call AN minus 1 hat because they think about the affine Weyl group of SLN hat. And so that would only have a Z to the N minus 1 here. And I don't really want GLN hat. Now that contains ones that have this property that f of I is greater than or equal to I. And that contains the ones that have this property that f of I is between I and I plus n. And so these are the ones that I was constructing above. Yes. Okay. Now, these are what are called juggling patterns. So, how do you think of them as a juggling pattern? A juggling pattern is that you're throwing a ball at a certain time, and it comes down at a certain time, or maybe just shortly before. So a ball will be thrown at time I, and it'll come down, and the next time will be thrown at time f of I. And I want it to be periodic with period n. And as a juggler, I would like balls to land after they are thrown. Okay. So I don't usually, as a juggler, insist on this silly condition that the height that a ball should come down before one period of the pattern. And the pattern that you typically see people juggling is f of I equals I plus 3. Okay. So if you've never seen that before, then it looks like this. So while one of these is in the air, I do two other throws. So each of these is being then thrown 1, 2, 3 steps later. Okay, so this is f of I equals I plus 3. And so you might think, oh, that's the pattern where n equals 1 and the first throw is the only throw is a 3, but that's larger than n. So the standard pattern, thinking of this as with n equals 1, I still want the other conditions here to apply, doesn't satisfy this condition. So the pattern 3-3-3 does, right? It's the same f, though it's just thought of with a different n. Okay, so let me just show you a couple of other examples of these patterns. So what jugglers actually talk about is they talk about f of I minus I, right? Which just says, you know, they don't say, oh, at time 5 I threw something that came down at time 12. They say, no, at time 5 I threw a 7. Well, how long it stay up. So let me do this. I'll do it by writing down a particular sequence of vectors first. So let's do the following example. And so this is repeating, right? So this guy is independent of all of these, and I have to wait until I get to here before it becomes dependent on itself. So that's going to come down 6 later. This guy is independent of all of these also, and him, so that's another 6. This guy is, it's not 0, but it becomes dependent on the next guy. So that's just a 1. This guy becomes dependent once you include this one. So that's a 5. And likewise, 1 and 5.
Did you mean when you have the condition vi, comma vj, dependent, do you mean that vi is a linear combination of
this? Because I took j smallest, that's implied. No. You're right. I'm sorry. I absolutely take it back. Yes. That's right. I'm sorry. I could write down an easy enough example. Right. So of course, right here, these two were dependent, but didn't involve that. I'm sorry. Involving I. That's right. So what is this pattern 661515? So when I actually interpret these and juggle them, I always figure I'm alternating hands. So I'm just, you know, which mathematically might say really there's just one hand that's juggling. I mean, I'm just going to write things out on a line, and it's really about one hand juggling, but I'll interpret it by alternating which hand has to do the work. So that means that an even number is going to come back down to the same hand, and an odd number comes to the other hand. So a 6 is then something like this that comes back to the same hand. And I'm going to have a couple of those, 6, 6. And then the 1, 5 is there's going to be a 1 and a 5 and a 1 and a 5. That a 1 is what you do, it's thrown, and then it's the very next ball to be thrown. So it's one of these very low, these handoff throws. So what do you see in 6, 6, 1, 5, 1, 5? There's going to be two balls in the middle. There's going to be two balls in the middle that are doing these 1-5s, and two balls on the outside that are doing 6s. Right? Yeah. Okay, so let me now say what this stuff had to do with this question. That's a theorem, yes. So the number of balls is the average of these throws, f of I minus I. So this is an ancient theorem at this point. I mean, this numbering system for juggling patterns is not mine. It was invented by a few jugglers in the mid-80s and is quite standard in the juggling world at this point. And this is one of the first theorems anybody proved about them. With n? Nothing yet. The number of balls is not the length of the pattern. What it has to do with the vectors, though, is it's equal to the dimension of the span of V1 up to Vn. No, because of this silly restriction, the I plus N. So as long as you're willing to take your juggling pattern like 3 and repeat it several times to be 3-3-3, then yes. So any particular F will satisfy this once you inflate N. But for any particular N, though, no, I've only got a finite number of juggling patterns. Okay. So why is this? Well, really what I want to know is, at any given time, how many balls are in the air. So that means how many vectors in the past, you know, I'm going to cut this thing at a certain time and ask how many vectors in the past correspond to balls that were thrown and are still in the air. Well, so what I can do is I can take the span of all the vectors in the past, and most of those vectors are already dependent on something, some set ahead of them. That means those balls have already landed. And only the ones that I only need for a basis for that span, I only need those balls that are still in the air, I only need those vectors that that are not dependent on other vectors in the past. And that gets me a basis for the span of all of them. And so that's the dimension of the span of all. Okay, so notice that this dependence, though. So I can take this set V1 up to Vn, and I'm going to assume that that the dimension of the span is k. Okay, so I'm going to take n tuples with a fixed span. And I'm going to take their span, and I'll end up in k planes and Cn. And now I can say I'd like them to have some fixed juggling pattern. And that will go to one stratum or open stratum produced by the algorithm. So what this is saying is, I decomposed the set of n tuples of vectors with a given span. I decomposed that into a bunch of strata, one for each juggling pattern, bounded juggling pattern. Right, we're bounded, I mean f of I less than equal I plus n. So I decomposed this set into a bunch of strata according to index by bounded juggling patterns. Because I only cared about linear independence, I can then mod out by GLK. And when I do, that just takes the span of those k vectors. And so each juggling pattern then gets me some subvariety of the Grassmannian, and those are exactly the subvarieties that are produced if you start with this x and you run the intersect, decompose, intersect, decompose, intersect, decompose algorithm. You get exactly these subvarieties. So let me say, the stuff that I'm telling you here is by me and Thomas Lamb and David Speyer, and it's on the archive. This particular stratification of the Grassmannian was studied by a bunch of people, in particular Lustig and Postnikov. And Postnikov was, I think, the first to notice that this stratification, to give a description of this stratification in which this cyclic symmetry is manifest. So, you know, the way I describe it, the cyclic symmetry is manifest. But Lustig described it as take Richardson varieties and flag manifolds and project them to the Grassmannian, and there it's not, completely not manifest. It also shows up, they were interested in it for studying total positivity. It also shows up if you deform the Grassmannian to a non-commutative space and you ask what are the T invariant subvarieties that deform along with it. The answer is these. So it's interesting for thinking about totally real sorts of things, for totally positive sorts of things, for thinking about non-commutative geometry. But I'm going to say why it's interesting for thinking about characteristic P geometry. So, any questions at this point? All right, so how do you prove something's reduced? So I've got R as a commutative Noetherian ring with unit. I'll call that a ring. I suppose there have been non-commutative rings here. So okay, it's a commutative ring. And so R is reduced, but we usually think of that as for all R that not zero, and or for all R and for all m more than 1, R to the m equals 0 implies R is 0. Okay, so no nilpotence. But I want to think about this slightly differently. I'm going to have a particular m and want that for all R, R to the n equals 0 implies that R equals 0. And it's not instantly obvious that these are equivalent, but it's pretty easy, because if you have a nilpotent, you can raise it to the last power before it dies, and then its square will be 0. So if you have, so already if nobody squares to 0, then nobody cubes to 0. That's what I'm saying here. Okay, so I'd like to talk about this and say that the kernel of the map that takes R to the M is 0. Right? It would be nice to think about this condition in this way, but you can't do that because the nth power map isn't linear, so it's not something that should properly be spoken of as having a kernel. But we can make it linear by working in characteristic P and taking M equal to P. So it makes sense if m equals p r is characteristic p. So this is my motivation, or this is how I can bear moving to characteristic p. That really I'm interested in, typically in things in characteristic 0, and But I'll use this sort of thing to prove, I'll prove something for infinitely many p, like reducedness for infinitely many p, and then there's stupid tricks that let you go from there to knowing that it's also true over the rationals. So, or over, you know, whatever characteristic zero field you want. So I'll be writing down polynomials over the integers, and then I'll be studying them over fp, and then I'll say, well, that tells me something nice about them over q. But this I think is really the, you know, the special thing you get to do over fp is to think of this as a linear map. So I'd like that map to be 1-to-1, right? And that's an interesting thing already, right? To say that a nonlinear map does this, that a nonlinear map only takes 0 to 0 and nothing else to 0, that doesn't tell you that it's injective. But if it's linear, it does tell you that. So that it has a one-sided inverse. So let me define what that one-sided inverse is supposed to do. Okay, so I've got a ring that's a characteristic p, and I'll define phi from R to R is a Frobenius splitting if, one, phi is additive. So you should think of phi as a pth root, okay? And maybe it seems strange to you that a pth root would be additive, but, well, a pth power is additive, and so this is supposed to be additive too. It isn't additive usually, but it is now. And being a pth root, the really obvious thing it should do is take pth roots, okay? I want a little bit more. I want to be able to pull pth powers out when I take a pth root, okay? Now, these are easy. There's an easy phi you can write down that satisfies these, which is 0. Okay, so these are actually not the difficult condition. The difficult condition is phi of 1 equals 1. That's the hard one. So, like, if you don't impose that, then the set of phis is itself an isobelian group. But now with this, it's just some affine thing modeled on the abelian group where phi of 1 equals 0. It's going to turn out to be easy to write down things that do this, and then the interest is in checking that. Okay? So what do you get out of a Frobenius splitting? And let me say, the place that I recommend reading about this is in the book by Brion and Kumar with Frobenius splitting in the title. So they didn't invent this. It was invented in the 80s by a bunch of other Indians, Mehta, Ramanathan, I'm going to forget some names, but mostly to study Schubert variety stuff. And I'll tell you some of the theorems that are proven about them in general in a minute. So the really easy theorem is that if R possesses a splitting, and when I say that R is split, I mean I've chosen one. I don't mean it's a splittable. I mean that somebody has splitted it. Okay, there's a fixed one. You know, it's oriented, not orientable, sort of point of view. So if R is split, then R is reduced. And you can figure out how you might prove that by putting these two together. That's really easy. And here's going to be the interesting thing. If I've got I an ideal in R, I'll call it compatibly split. And I'll often leave off the word compatibly because you're just supposed to say split means one word for one thing for rings and one thing and a different thing for ideals. But I'll call it compatibly split. This guy has already been split. If P of I is contained in I. Now, since R is split, it has no nilpotents, so I contains all of its PEEF powers, so the other inclusion is automatic. That so in fact, P of I equals I. But this is the interesting one to ask for. So here's a theorem, and usually I spend 5 minutes proving all parts of this theorem just to show you it is that easy, but I think I'm going to skip it this time. So but the very easy theorem that you can get in section 1.1 of Brion Kumar is that if I is split, then R mod I is split, and hence I is radical. Because R mod I is reduced. So this is you should think of split as a better condition than being a radical ideal, a much, much more robust and easy to work with condition than radical. If I and J are both split ideals, then I intersects J and I plus J are split. So this is completely stupid, right? This is like the intersection of two ideals is an ideal, okay? This is just a set theoretic fact. This is almost completely stupid. It uses axiom one, okay? So it says you add two split ideals, you get a split ideal. But that means that it's radical. So this is what we're going to be saying. I'll have two subschemes. I'll have two reduced, two subvarieties, two nice reduced subschemes, and I'll intersect them, and usually that would be horrible. But now, it'll still be compatibly split, and therefore reduced. So, you should avoid the word reduced as long as possible. Stay with compatibly split, and only at the very end surprise people with your theorem that something's reduced. That's my recommendation. So, what's the other one is that if I is split and J is arbitrary, then the colon ideal, I colon J, is split. And which is to say, I's components are split. So, one of the steps in my algorithm was to decompose the subscheme into its components, and you can do decompositions using colon ideals. So the proof from here to here is about two lines, whereas these proofs are one line. Okay. There's another theorem I should mention that was only proven about.
What's a colon ideal?
It's things that you can multiply by somebody in J and they'll end up in I. And so, for example, XY looks like that, and I want to colon out X. So I look for things, for ring elements that I can multiply by X, and they'll end up in here, and I get Y. So I'd like to take this guy and rip out that, and I get this. Okay, it's for ripping out components and getting what's left. It's the algebraic version of that. Okay, anyway, it's a very easy way to, this is very easy to prove, and it's already known that you can get all of the components from as colon ideals. So, an interesting theorem proven this past year by Carl Schwede and given a nice treatment by Kumar and Mehta is that once you fix R and phi, there are only finitely many compatibly split ideals. So, in the case of the Grassmannian, Thomas and David and I have proven that these subvarieties. There is a Frobenius splitting on the Grassmannian that exactly splits those subvarieties, and that's as good as you can do. There isn't going to be some other splitting that splits them and something else. Once you split at the anticanonical divisor X, then that's as much as you get, and you can't split anything more. But so when I say having given you this nice family of subvarieties on the Grassmannian, in some sense, that's as good as you're going to do. Nobody's going to invent another family of subvarieties that includes those that where everybody's compatibly Frobenius split.
All primes at the same time?
Or? That one works for all primes at the same time, yeah. Okay. So, any questions at this point? Anyway, so what's then, of course, how am I going to prove the original theorem? What I want to prove is that there's a splitting on affine space, that on so on that ring, a splitting just on the polynomial ring, that compatibly splits the ideal defining F, and therefore, because of these, it compatibly splits everything that the algorithm spits out, which is the matrix Schubert varieties, and therefore any matrix Schubert variety intersect any other one or any union of other ones is reduced. So let me tell you the theorems I have about that. So first I'm going to mention what I consider a curiosity, but it's cute. I haven't found any application for it, but it was the first time I did this sort of mathematics. So remember the set. Okay, the setting now is R is going to be a polynomial ring, and F is a polynomial. So x1 through xn, and x1 is a polynomial of degree less than or equal n. So the theorem Chevalet-Varning is that if the degree, and n I'm going to take to be more than 0 to avoid annoyances, if the degree of f is less than n, then the number of points in affine space where in the hypersurface defined by f is a multiple of p. Okay? And the theorem I prove is if the degree of f is equal to n, and this thing is not congruent to 0, then there exists a unique splitting on R. Let me leave out unique. Be unique if I ask for things to be homogeneous, but I haven't. There exists a splitting on R, splitting F equals 0. So once you split that hypersurface, then you split all its components, all their intersections, all their components, all their intersections, blah, 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 blah. Everything's compatibly split. They're all those intersections are reduced. So I can get that as long as the number of points is not a multiple of p. Now, this theorem is not going to help me yet with that f, because the degree of this f is not n squared. It's too small. And so because it's too small, Chevalet-Varning will say, oh, it's the number is a multiple of p. So here's my new f. It's again going to be the product from I equals 1 to n minus 1 of these I by I determinants. But it's also going to be the product from I equals 1 to n of these I by I determinants. Okay? And this polynomial has a fun property, which is if we pick out the anti-diagonal terms, so what that means, when you have an I by I determinant, it's a sum of I factorial terms. And each one is, you put a permutation in there and blah, blah, blah. One of those is the term where you take the product of the anti-diagonals, of the anti-diagonal entries. So it's easy enough to put some weighting on the matrix entries such that the heaviest monomial in every one of those polynomials is the antidiagonal one. That you make this be heaviest, and the things nearby it a little lighter, things nearby that a little lighter. There's lots of ways to do it, and I don't care which one you use, so long as you pick out the antidiagonal terms. And what do you get? Well, the product of these antidiagonals is this, and then the product of these minus the big one, then the product of these antidiagonals is this. And so we get that the initial term of F is just the product of all Xij. Okay, so in particular, it's degree n squared, but it has a better property that the initial term is just the product of all the variables. Okay, and so for my last theorem, if the initial term, so I've still got the degree of f is at most n, and I have, if the initial term of f is the product of all your variables, so the point being each to the power 1, so not multiplicities, then there exists a splitting, and it's easy to say what it is, but I don't really have to. There's just a splitting on this polynomial ring that splits this hypersurface. And so it splits all the things you make out of it, and so they're all reduced, and their intersections are reduced, and so on. And for any y inside affine space over FP produced by this algorithm, init y is also reduced, also known as a Stanley-Reisner scheme. So it's got a Grubner basis where the initial terms are square free. So that's true for this hypersurface. It's a its initial ideal is just given by this square free monomial. But I'm saying all of these other subvarieties you meet along the way, their initial ideals are also radical. And I knew this theorem, this fact, in the matrix Schubert variety case. Ezra Miller and I proved it for matrix Schubert varieties, and we actually identified what that initial ideal was, and that its components correspond to pipe dreams. So this theorem doesn't tell you what init y actually is. It just tells you that the way it's proven is that I degenerate f to its leading term, and at the same time I degenerate y to its initial ideal. And the Frobenius splitting defined by f turns into the Frobenius splitting defined by this. And the compatibly split ideals then are just unions of coordinate spaces. And being compatibly split is a closed condition in the space of pairs of a splitting and a subvariety. So this guy is still compatibly split with respect to the splitting determined by this, which means it's radical. And it's a union of coordinate spaces, which is this condition. Stop there.